This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Later in the show, a look at the impact poverty is having on local Latino families. But first, the American Can Company building in Northside, built in 1921, sat for years, vacant or nearly vacant, subject to decay and vandalism. But the building, listed on the National Register of Historic Places, has undergone a complete transformation over the last decade and now houses apartments and commercial space. Here to discuss the history and revitalization of the building are Mary Croner, co-owner of Ruth's Parkside Cafe, which is located in the American Can Company building, and Dan Hurley, local historian, host and producer of Newsmakers on Local 12 WKRC, and director of Leadership Cincinnati with the Cincinnati USA Regional Chamber. Do you have any stories to share about the building? You can join the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at WVXU.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Dan and Mary, thanks so much for being here this afternoon.
Good to be here today.
And Mary, this all revolves around a project that you have underway, the American Can Factory Reunion. What's that about?
Well, I put the word reunion in quotes whenever I'm talking about it, because most people that would have worked at the American Can Factory are, if they're still with us, are in their 90s or 80s. There are, I think, the possibility of some younger folks out there, but not many. I'm trying to gather as many people who have any memories or associations with that building while they're still here to connect the rest of us with it. And I have, this has grown out of customers coming in who, oh, my grandfather worked here, or my mother baked pies in the cafeteria, and the food was so good, people would come to the cafeteria from outside of the factory for lunch, and just all of these stories. And it took a few months of being open for me to realize, oh, I should be doing something with these. These are great stories. So some months into us, maybe 6 months after we had been there, I started collecting email addresses and phone numbers of anybody who told me anything about the building. And God bless them. Now they have payback because I'm calling them and emailing them and asking them to come in and share their stories and their photos. And I've had some interesting little connections already, and I'm looking forward to more.
Now, when did your restaurant open in the building, and why did you pick that location?
Well, we opened 2 years ago in October. We'll be 2 years old in October. We had looked all around Northside. David, my co-owner, partner, and I are both residents of Northside, and we love Northside. And that building seemed out of our reach until the Neighborhood Business Association got the entertainment district designation, and that allowed us to go in without having to buy a complete liquor license, which made it affordable for us to think about doing it, and we loved it. We went in, we looked at one of the empty bays for a long time and drooled over it and realized we couldn't afford it, and then one day just walked two bays over. Now, at this point, these bays were just these huge open spaces. There was nothing in there, but we were way at the back of one and looking
right,
out.
It was a big industrial facility at one point. So
the bay that we're actually in is the former train unloading dock. So the ceilings are 28 feet high. They had to accommodate a train, but just looking out from the very back of that, against, you just looked at this beautiful bank of windows, and it was just sky from floor to ceiling. And so we fell in love with that space.
So in the rehab version of the American Can Factory, have they kept that industrial feel?
Oh, absolutely.
How so?
In the lofts too. They all have those big, giant, enormous windows and, just brick and steel.
It's a substantial building. I mean, this was a manufacturing building as part of the whole machine tool tradition in Cincinnati industrial history, and it is a building that is made to carry heavy loads. So what you have is an incredibly strong building with very high ceilings. The big windows are somewhat unusual in buildings like that. Sometimes you don't want that, they'll reduce the window space and you don't get a lot of light. But in this building, you get tremendous light. And by the way, what Mary didn't mention as a patron of her restaurant, great food. Okay. It's really, and she's known.
Dan, how tall a building is this? How many square feet are we talking? It's what, about five or six stories?
It's five, I think.
It's five stories. Yeah, I think so. And it's, It was a very large building. Now, American Can, this was one of the places, and they had, at one time, they had 10 of these machine shops. This is where they designed and manufactured the tools.
So they weren't making cans there?
No, they were making the tools that made the cans. And then they had other locations all over the United States, including two others in Cincinnati, where they were canning things, or, you know, they were making the, they were actually making the cans. And think about a couple of things. One, a couple of our industries here, beer. Okay. And the whole concept of the beer can. There's a whole history of the beer can. And some people know a lot about that locally. And also think about Procter & Gamble, which in this city, you almost always have to think about Procter & Gamble. So what we take for granted today is going to end up in a plastic container, whether that's detergent or whether that's Crisco. Those were always in cans, in tin cans. So American Can Company and its competitor, Continental Can, they were the ones who had designed and built the machines and then made it possible for companies to produce the machines themselves that they needed in order to fill it with beer, fill it with Crisco, whatever. And those were scattered all over the United States. But there was 10 of these so-called machine shops, and Cumminsville was one of those. Northside was one of those.
And how big of a factor was American Can in the local economy? I mean, how many people did it employ? And
you know, I went back getting ready for this interview and read all of the newspaper articles I could find on the plant. And two things just pop out of the page at me. First are the numbers. And depending on how you look at it, in the mid-1950s, sort of post-war, when they're really doing well, it gets up to about 750 unionized workers, United Steel workers, plus another 100 in the offices. So that's about 850. Now, another report indicates it may get as close to 1,000. I have not seen that myself. But be that as it may, we're talking about very large, and we're talking about a unionized workforce. So part of the story here is the interaction between management and labor. And, you know, today the idea of people going out on strikes in these sorts of manufacturing companies, we hardly ever hear about that in the news. It's just a regular factor here. It's a really reminder of a different era for the people who work there.
Now, the factory was in operation until 1963. Why was it shut down eventually?
Well, the announcement comes in the middle of December, December the 15th, 1961, that they will shut it down. And the reason that the company said, now this is one of its machine shops, there had been 10 a decade before that. Then they cut it back in order to and by 1961, the beginning of 61, there were 3, and then they shut Northside's down, so there's only 2 left. And the, what they blamed it on was a 1950 U.S. Supreme Court decision that said that they had to share the patents for manufacturing the sort of machinery that they made that could seal tin cans. They couldn't – American Can Company and Continental Can couldn't hold on and control the actual production of those cans solely. They had to sell it to any customer who wanted to buy it, and that undercut their ability to then be the provider not only of the machinery but of the cans themselves. That undercut the company, and within a decade, it was financially, it was just – really declining.
And as I understand, somebody else came in, tried to run something out of that facility, but they were closed within a matter of about 12 years, if
that
I remember
would be
right.
Cleveland Automatic.
Yeah, Cleveland.
Right.
Yeah.
Also, wouldn't plastic have had something to do with that?
It does if you take the long view. But at the time, and that's what's always important, we can look back, you know, historians can play tricks on people who lived in the past, and it's unfair to them. It's like, well, why didn't they see the how important plastic was really going to be. At the time, They're not talking about that. But in reality, we know that there was this more fundamental shift going on in packaging. And there's no better place to understand the shifts in packaging than Cincinnati with Procter & Gamble here, because they're driving a lot of that. So, yes, those big swings are occurring, but it wasn't clear to people at the time that that was really the problem.
You know what they always say about hindsight, Dan. So,
it's
always 2020.
It is. And, you know, for the people at that time, the real task of a historian is to see the world through the eyes of the people in the past, at a different place, at a different time, and not impose your own view, because otherwise you just lose their insight.
Maria, what kind of responses have you been getting so far? You're looking for stories, you're looking for photos, you're looking for memorabilia as well, I would take it.
Right.
What's popped up so far?
I have this wonderful little book. This story, a woman came in and she said, oh, I worked here, my uncle worked here, my aunt, my cousin, her dad worked there. And in fact, her dad passed away at work. So she had to come and claim her dad with her mother. I mean, a very traumatic story. She's telling me one day in the middle of lunch. And so she's certainly somebody I've kept in touch with. Simultaneously, I'm asking everybody, you can ask my staff, everybody who walks in, I'm like, do you know anything about anybody who's ever worked in the American Can Factory? I'm asking everybody in the world right now. So one of our meat delivery guys is Larry. Larry's in his late 70s. And I said, Larry, do you have any connection with anybody? And he's going to go ask. He comes back a couple days later. He's been at the KFC hall drinking, and his buddy Ed is 90. And Ed retired from American Can, and so did Ed's dad. And then the next time Larry came, he has this little book from Ed, and it's like the class of 1956 of the American Can Factory. It's a little booklet that has every department and every person's picture and name. And just reading the titles is educational to somebody like me. You get into the whole heat treat, weld, forge and power, bench fly, sheet metal, layout, painters, large machine tools. It goes on and on. And they're just these, you know, these old black and white photos. Well, anyhow, this original woman who I'd been talking to had included her uncle and aunt's name in one of her emails to me. And sure enough, I flipped to the cafeteria page, and there's her Uncle Herbert and her Aunt Margie and her cousin Helen. And so I take a picture on my phone. Now, this woman is maybe 80 years old, and I get to send her a picture of her people at work. I just love that. I love that. And then I have this amazing book that celebrates the 50th anniversary of American Can. So it was written in 51, I guess.
Yes, 1951.
And it is just full of wonderful, they look to be hand-colored drawings. Some of them are photographs. Most of them are drawings of the kind of machinery. And it's just a great book. I imagine if you're reading Apple stockholder things and they're talking about how great they are and how important they are to the world, this book is everything about canning and how the world has revolved around the needs of canning, which in many ways is true. It has changed how we do food.
We will continue our conversation about the American Can Company building, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. My guest this afternoon, Mary Croner, co-owner of Ruth's Parkside Cafe, located in the American Can Company building, and Dan Hurley, local historian, host and producer of Newsmakers on Local 12 WKRC, and director of Leadership Cincinnati with the Cincinnati USA Regional Chamber. You can join our conversation, 513-419-7100, email talk at WVXU.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter.
Mark, something I wanted to point out, playing off of what Mary was just talking about. What Mary is doing is absolutely critical. Usually when people think about doing history, they think that there are documents. You know, there are newspapers, there are letters,
there's something organized out there, right?
There's something in print.
Yeah.
Well, there's two problems with that. One, there may not be that much or not enough to really put the story together. And secondly, they almost always put the story together from, in this particular case, a company history or an industrial history, from the top down. What Mary is doing is gathering the stories of how that experience of working in this kind of industrial environment, what that was from the bottom up, from the human side up. And oral history is so absolutely essential that we respect it. And it has to be tested and all of those sorts of good things to make sure that you've got something valid. But the point here is there are stories that you'll never find in print, that the person who is just comes into that restaurant, who connects you to somebody, that's wonderful. This absolutely, my only thing as a historian is make sure all that gets written down and deposited someplace.
Dan, why do you think it sat vacant for so many years? Why do you think the building wasn't just demolished and something put in its place?
It would be really tough to demolish that building.
I was going to say, okay.
It's a fortress. It's heavy concrete and steel.
Reinforced.
Is it packed into a tight area as well? Would that have...
It is, but I don't think that would have prevented it from being brought down. There's lots of ways you can do that. But it was just, if you don't have a new use for the land, then why bring an old building down? Buildings, if a building, a residential building that's made out of wood or even not made out of wood, you can disintegrate over a long period of time. This building was going to survive. Look at the Crosley building, not too far from this building, that just keeps, looks terrible. But the point is, the basic structure is, it's a fortress. I mean, it would take a lot of money to take that building down. And unless you have a substitute use, in this particular case, adaptive reuse came along first, so that the building itself could be used. So you don't have to take the building down, but people can now live there. And we're repopulating the center city by using creatively these old structures.
Mary, how did it land on the National Register of Historic Places? How did that come about?
And you may know more about this, Dan, but I know that Bloomfield Schoen, the architects that undertook the redoing of this building, would have been the ones to submit the application to get on that register. And I imagine that was quite a process, but it served to help them get funding, tax abatements and credits and historical credits.
Historic tax credits.
Yes. To proceed with that, because it would have been, I don't know how anybody could have ever undertaken that project otherwise, because it was so massive and it needed massive cleanup. There were environmental issues in certain parts of the building that they did. They went to extraordinary lengths to clean up.
You know, this is, you see this same thing happening with Music Hall that's in the news today. Union Terminal. Lots of buildings need historic tax credits in order to make the total funding package work. No money comes immediately just because you're on the National Register. I mean, you don't get any cash from that, but it has been possible in the last 15 years or so to get historic tax credits. But as the state's budgets have been changing, that's being slimmed down and or cut out. And that's why Music Hall needed to get this done before those tax credits disappeared.
Well, and it's to the betterment of everybody. I mean, for so many years, Northside, it wasn't in decline. I think people have been at it since the 70s of actively trying to reclaim many empty or, buildings that were just starting to fall apart. And that building was at a major intersection, and it just was this huge, monstrous, empty, broken glass, overgrown weeds thing that was just there. It was so big you almost quit noticing it in the course of your daily passing, because it was just always there. And as the neighborhood has, one house at a time, one shop at a time, been reclaimed, to have that building reclaimed, I feel like it's just part of this wonderful package.
I've lived in Northside for 12 years of my life. I haven't lived there since 1986, which was when Mary came. Northside's this wonderful place that people keep investing in, because it is, and people have recognized it for a long time, it's the urban walking community that people now in the suburbs are trying to build and start from scratch in some cornfield. Well, it's there. The structures are there, but people have been fixing up homes. I fixed up two. I thought I was going to kill myself. But the point is, but on the other hand, Northside hasn't become some yuppie place either. It takes sort of two steps forward and one step back usually, and consequently has the grittiness. This is an industrial community. This is in the industrial heartland of a corridor of Cincinnati. I drive in and out of work every day, to and from my house to work on Spring Grove Avenue. I hate getting on the expressway, but the entire industrial history of this city in the 19th and 20th century can be read on Spring Grove Avenue. Yeah. And we don't ever want to lose that, and we're not going to lose that because of places like Northside.
513-419-7100 to join the conversation. Let's talk with Kurt in Anderson. Hi, Kurt. Kurt, go ahead.
Hi. Yes. I went to Vice President Biden's dedication of the remodeling of American Can for sentimental reasons, because my father worked there. He was the chief designer there from the early 1950s to about 1960. And he had many draftsmen and engineers under him. My dad was trained in Germany, came to the United States in the late 1920s. He worked for American Can for many years, well, for his entire career practically. When I saw the building when Vice President Biden came, I was just saddened to see the sorry state that it was in.
Oh, I believe
that. And I thought that this was going to be a waste of taxpayers' money. And I'm so, so happy to hear that the project has succeeded.
Okay.
The only other comment I have is that it was my impression that there were only 5 machine shops, not 10. But, okay. I'm not the authority to dispute that. That's just my memories from a little kid.
It depends on when you what date you use. So 1951 was the date I was using. One thing about success, it's not just the success of this building. This building has now triggered the construction of a whole new apartment complex right next door and goes out to Hamilton Avenue on the property of the old Johnson Lumber Company. So this has been a success in multiple ways.
Kurt, thank you for the phone call.
Kurt, I hope you come to Ruth's on September 27th and tell us something or another.
For that reunion.
And bring some pictures.
Let's talk with Jim in Wyoming. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I'm enjoying your show and a fan of the restaurant. But I just wanted to mention that across the street at Building Value, they had a lot of the patterns from the building, from the can company. And those are so fun to look at and try to imagine what they were all about.
Now, I have heard that those were actually patterns from left over from Cleveland Automated that American Can had cleared out. Now, I don't know if that's true, but somebody knows that answer. But they are really neat pieces, really amazing.
The patterns in themselves are an expression of an art form, a craft form that, with CAD and with modern design and with 3D printing is disappearing and is going to disappear. But patterns in themselves are beautiful objects.
Oh, they're made out of mahogany. They are so intricate. We at one point, our restaurant was filled with those. And then, of course, we had to ask that they be moved so we could start work. But they're really gorgeous.
Thanks for the call, Jim. Let's talk with John in Over the Rhine. Hi, John.
Yes.
You're on. Go right ahead.
Oh, I apologize. I love this show. It's number one, it features three great Cincinnati treasures with Mary, Dan, and you, Mark.
Thank you.
it's a great discussion, and it's a great view of Cincinnati's manufacturing history. But it's also a reminder to me that manufacturing in Ohio isn't dead. Ohio is the number three state after California and Texas in terms of manufacturing, and the Cincinnati-Dayton area, if you put them together, is the largest manufacturing area in the state. at $60 billion. Cleveland would be number two, a little bit after that. And a man fairly recently, I think 3 years ago, named Matt Anthony, started a business accelerator here. Business accelerators, which help people start businesses, are kind of hot. And Matt started one that's the only one in the United States that does physical product startups. So what I would say is it's great to look at the history, but also great to look forward to the launch of more local manufacturing and physical products businesses, which are our legacy here.
Thank you, John. We appreciate the call.
It is so important that we continue as a society, as an economy, making things. I mean, they're making something, not just moving paper and dollar bills around virtually. It's real.
Mary, again, remind us of the project that you have going on and what exactly you're looking for, and then the event that's coming up.
The event is Sunday, September 27th, and we're calling it the American Can Factory Reunion. And I'm looking for anybody who has any stories associated with the American Can Factory building from any era, any photos, any connections. Maybe you know somebody who worked there, and we're going to get together at Ruth's Parkside Cafe, which is in the building. And I've got a little collection of photos. I've actually got music from the 1920s and some fashion from the 1920s to make it a little fun. And we'll give a little brief historic overview of the factory, but really we just want to pass the mic and hear what people have to say.
Will it be possible to get food?
Well, we're not open for dinner on Sunday. I know, I love that. Thank you. We will have light refreshments.
I've noticed. I do too, though, Dan.
And it is late lunchtime.
Well, Mary and Dan, thank you so much for being here with me this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Mary Croner is co-owner of Ruth's Parkside Cafe, located in the American Can Company building. And Dan Hurley, local historian, host, and producer of Newsmakers on Local 12 WKRC, and director of Leadership Cincinnati with the Cincinnati USA Regional Chamber. Coming up, a look at poverty and the local Latino community. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.